White Bread Foundation. We're taping our king beaten off his crown. My country, tears of the sweet land of irony, spoonful of sugar to wash it down.
And welcome to episode 17 of Culture Wars Radio. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Dan Ray. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, buddy. I feel like I ought to give you some sort of a chip or something. You've managed to go now for an entire week without being hospitalized.
That's right. Like an AA one-week chip?
Exactly. Yeah. Do we have a one-week chip we can award you for valiantly staying out of intensive care? I don't know.
Well, I haven't been in intensive care yet.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, doing better. Things are headed in the right direction here. So
good.
So happy to have stayed out of the hospital because my arms are still so beat up from the IVs that I'm like, well, I don't know where they would put one if I went back in.
Well, and you never get any sleep in the hospital, and you get tired of the hospital food. It just is not a fun experience.
You see all these things about people that were hospitalized with exhaustion, and I'm like, that's the last place I'm going if I'm exhausted.
Right, yeah.
I'm exhausted when I get out of the hospital.
You know? Yeah, they poke and prod you every 45 minutes to an hour and a half. There's no way you can get any sleep.
Yeah. I know this is no place to get any rest. That's for sure. So,
well, good for you. We're glad you're setting a record here.
So, obviously, the big story this week is this Jamal Khashoggi story.
Right.
The Saudi journalist who's been in the United States since 2009. He's a legal resident. Murdered on October 2nd at the Saudi embassy in Ankara, Turkey. After 2 weeks of claiming that they knew absolutely nothing about it, that Khashoggi had gone to the embassy, gotten the papers he needed, and walked out on his own, which we knew was a lie because the video showed him going in, but not coming out.
Yes.
They trotted out a totally new story. So the other day, they finally said, okay, he did die in the embassy, but it was an accident. He started a fist fight.
Yes, which of course you do when someone comes after you with a bone saw. One would tend to react, shall we say, violently to that sort of thing, I would think.
Well, they claim he started it, you know, you're just going to square off at an embassy with, you know, 15 security staff.
Yeah, that's what you do.
Swinging away, you know.
Of course, yes.
So they say they put him into a chokehold to subdue him, and he accidentally died. Accidentally, you know.
Yeah, don't you hate when that happens?
Yeah,
you
put somebody in a chokehold. It's like the old mafia thing. You know, he accidentally fell on a knife 27 times.
Yeah, well, and in this case, he accidentally fell on a bone saw several times. You know, these things happen amongst friends.
The bone saw has not actually been confirmed, but
no,
that's
okay.
The reports. There are some things about this on the other side that haven't really been confirmed, like. You know, they say they have these audio and video tapes, but they never, Turkey does, but they never actually release them. Now, there are reports that they have shared them with our intelligence services, but no one else has ever heard them.
Well, keep in mind the source. I mean, right. Erdogan is not exactly the most reliable historian, I can imagine.
Sure. So, I mean, there's some questions on both sides of this, but it's absolutely obvious that this man was murdered.
Yes.
In there. And they say, you know, and Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia who runs the country, you know, after initially saying that, I don't know, he was only there for about an hour, he left. We don't know what happened to him.
Yeah, no telling.
Says, look, you know, I didn't have anything to do with this. I sent them there to talk to him. You know.
Yes, for all definitions of talk that include chokeholds and dismemberment, yes. I think that's a fair statement.
Right. So, the thing is, like, even if he did like start a brawl, like you had all those people around there, you couldn't subdue him without killing him.
Really? Yeah.
You know, there's just so many questions that this raises.
And wasn't one of the people there a coroner or
An autopsy expert? Yeah.
Yeah. What a coincidence!
Which
you know,
they said he. Well, they offered two different excuses for that.
Yeah, I do tell. I'm
so the
curious.
First one was they said, "Well, we only sent him in case fingerprints needed to be taken ahead of time." By the way,
and
he didn't
on
show
what
up after?
Yeah, on what basis would they think that fingerprints, A, might need to be taken, B, might need to be lifted, and C, that a coroner would be the best person to do
exactly.
that?
Exactly. It's ridiculous. So then, after the second story, then they said, okay, you know, the autopsy guy was there because he was an expert at cleaning up a crime scene.
Oh, well,
so he was just part of the cover up. He didn't actually do anything, you know.
Okay, yeah, okay, sure.
So, but there's question number one, what happened to the body?
Well,
the body's never been found. Now, the Saudis now say that they gave the body to a, quote, local collaborator.
Uh-huh.
But they haven't told the Turkish government or anybody else who it is. So they can find out what the guy did with it.
Didn't the Turks send an investigation, a forensic investigation team into
yes.
the scene where this was supposed to have taken place?
Yes.
Okay. And I guess we haven't heard anything about the results of that investigation.
Well,
right?
The Turks are saying, you know, I'm sure they cleaned up the crime scene very well, you know.
Well, sure, but you know, there still is this magic substance called luminol that will detect whether blood has been someplace. You know, don't they have that in Turkey? You know, take a can of luminol in there and spray it around, dudes.
Yeah, I don't really know. We haven't heard much about the results of that, but Turkey obviously says they don't believe Saudi Arabia's story.
Yeah, I don't think that Erdogan is a really big fan of the Saudi regime, do you?
Not particularly, no. So, okay, question number one, what happened to the body? Question number two, why did they lie about it for 2 weeks? I mean, obviously they knew it was going to be really controversial, and that, you know, the claim that Bin Salman only found out about this alleged brawl several days after it took place is so absurd. I mean, the day it happened and became public, if he didn't order it, what would you do?
Well, let me float a couple of theories. A, the Saudis don't care. B, the Saudis don't care. And here's a third one. C, the Saudis don't care.
Well, I think they care now.
I doubt it.
Because they're starting to lose some business over it.
Well,
and at least initially. And, you know,
what kind of business are they losing? People aren't coming to their conference. They refuse to play their reindeer game. So what?
Right. But that was a conference on foreign investment.
Yeah,
and so there's a lot of companies who have come out and said, you know, we're just not going to be a part of this, you know, and so I how that ultimately turns out in terms of what it costs them, I think now the Saudis do care and they're trying to clean up the mess that they made, you know, the story just so strains credulity. Like I said, if he didn't order it to happen, if this was all just some rogue agents, you know, and it was an accident, well. Wouldn't you immediately call the embassy to find out what happened?
Of course, yeah.
So are we really to believe that all 15 of the people they sent there and everyone at the embassy told them that they had no idea what had happened to this guy, that he had come in and left peacefully?
Sure, yeah. That sounds entirely plausible to me.
And nobody said, he got into a big brawl and he ended up dying. You know, if that's the reality, that would be the reality, right?
Oh, you mean that guy.
Right, that guy.
Yeah, now that I remember it, a guy did come in, and there was a huge brawl, and it just so happened, conveniently, that we had a coroner with a bone saw, and poor guy, he just got so upset, and he went to pieces, and that was it. You know?
Yes, he fell to pieces, exactly.
Yes, he just fell to pieces right in front of us. It was really a sad thing.
And
we
of
didn't
course,
know what
it's an embassy. There are cameras everywhere.
Yes, right.
So, you know, it's far more credible to believe that MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, sent an assassination team to Turkey to kill him. That seems pretty, you know, the obvious explanation here.
I'm leaning that direction at this point. But I don't know about you.
But here's the thing. Even if that's not the case, even if we just sent them there to arrest the guy and take him back to Saudi Arabia and throw him in prison, why would that be okay?
Well, it wouldn't.
Right. I mean, what could justify that? He's an American resident, not a citizen, but a resident. He's lived here for nearly a decade. He's done nothing wrong. He criticized the Saudi government. That's it.
That's it. That's all it takes.
Since when do we think it's acceptable for our alleged allies to kidnap American residents and throw them in prison forever for criticizing a government?
Well, I have a hard time putting a precise date on it, Ed, but let me suggest that it began sometime around January 20th, 2017.
Right.
You know, once again, I'm just spitballing here. Right. I'm not throwing out any conclusive determination.
And look, but, I mean, let's admit, I mean, adversary government has looked the other way, you know, for a long, far longer than Trump has been around about Saudi human rights violations.
Yeah, I'm not so naive as to suggest that our let's just say casual disinterest in Saudi human rights violations began and will end with Trump. No, I'm not suggesting that.
Right.
But what I am suggesting is that when you have a president who comes right out and says, essentially, we don't care what happens to journalists, and goes even farther than that, and praises political candidates here who attack journalists.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in a couple minutes, yeah.
I imagine we probably were, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think my point is that obviously sends a message, don't you think?
And a president who has clearly tilted American foreign policy in the Middle East.
No question.
Towards Saudi Arabia and away from the United Arab Emirates. That's been a very, very public change.
Yep.
I mean, look, it was his first foreign trip.
Sure.
It was to Saudi Arabia, where they put up billboards singing his praises.
The more interesting question behind all of this to me is the one that follows what you're saying, which is why? Why has the Trump administration decided to tilt the foreign policy field towards the Saudis?
Because he hates Iran.
He hates Iran, but as with all things Trump, I think we need to follow the money, don't you?
Yes, absolutely. I think the fact that they are the strategic counterbalance in the region against Iran, and he has a real problem with Iran. I mean, he just, for some reason, he thinks Iran is like the most uniquely evil country in the world. In fact, I'm going to read the quote for you here in a minute. He did an interview with the Washington Post that was published this morning. Trump did, and he made some really bizarre comments about it. First of all, he acknowledged that obviously the Saudi government had lied about the whole thing, and that he wasn't sure that this latest excuse was really true or not.
Yeah, okay.
But he rejected the idea that we should want anyone other than MBS in charge, and this is what he said about MBS. Quote, he's seen as a person who can keep things under check. I mean that in a positive way.
Okay.
He said that he is, quote, considered by far the strongest person, and he truly loves his country.
Can I translate that into Donald Trump language for you?
Sure.
He seems to me like an authoritarian and a strongman. And frankly, those are qualities that I admire in foreign leaders and wish that I could get away with more of it myself. So we're going to stick with him.
Ding, 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 ding. We have a winner.
Thank you so much. What's my prize?
Nothing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the strongest person who keeps things under check. I'm pretty sure that means the most ruthless dictator.
There you go.
And remember, I mean that in a positive way.
Exactly, yes. You know, yes. Yes.
It's like you and I keep saying, he admires this.
Of course he does.
Because he
and
wishes he could do it.
Yep, wishes he could.
But the interview got even weirder when he started talking about Iran. And he said that Saudi Arabia was, quote, a good counterbalance to the world. Iran, they're as evil as it gets. They're probably laughing at this situation as they see it. Iran is as evil as it gets. He said, we've got nobody else over there to help protect Israel. Hey, he thinks Saudi Arabia protects Israel?
Yeah, what? Run that one by me again. You've got to be kidding me.
In what universe is that true? I mean, they don't like Hezbollah, yeah. But that's because Hezbollah is Shiite and is aligned with Iran. So Iran sponsors Shia terrorism. Saudi Arabia sponsors Sunni terrorism.
You know, everything that you said sounded to me like he was channeling John Bolton, except for the last line. I don't think Bolton's that stupid. That's got to be Trump's original. Don't you think he threw that in there?
I don't know where the heck that came from.
Yeah, that's just patent Trump stupidity.
And look, I mean, Iran's not a good country. You know, I mean,
no,
it's got its own problems.
I'm not defending Iran, but I mean, that's got Bolton written all over it.
Right. But why does he think that Iran is like this unique evil in the world, and Saudi Arabia is not? You know, they're guilty of pretty much the same things.
Well, number one, John Bolton said so. Number two, the Saudis send us, the United States, a bunch of cash for all the military hardware we send them, and apparently also send Donald Trump some cash. He's bragged about all the millions, hundreds of millions, indeed, that the Saudis have given him for what he calls Trump toys. So, again, follow the money. I think you get your answers.
And he continues to insist that we will not cancel the planned sale of weapons to Saudi Arabia because he doesn't want to hurt American companies like Boeing.
Of course.
But he shows no such concerns when it comes to sanctions against Iran.
Sure.
Studies estimate that the sanctions against Iran, which he reimposed when he pulled out of the nuclear agreement, had cost American companies $175 billion in revenue, including Boeing, by the way, which had a deal to sell them 110 airplanes. Now, that doesn't bother him.
Of course it doesn't.
So, you know, obviously the argument there is hypocritical. If you want a good reason not to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, how about because they're used in their war against Yemen?
There you go. Yes. to torture, kill, and destroy civilians. Yep.
Right.
I'll buy that.
The UN says that Yemen is the greatest humanitarian tragedy in the world today. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have died. That's a pretty good reason not to give them more weapons to keep going, right?
I agree. And look, I think the thing that puts the worst taste in my mouth about all of this is that Trump has essentially announced that the rule of law, morality, compassion, decency, these are all things that are now up for sale. We're willing to look the other way. To your human rights violations, to your overt acts of war in violation of international law targeting civilians, we're willing to look the other way as long as you run up a sufficient tab with the United States and or with Donald Trump.
Right, with Trump Tower, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Buy enough condos from me. And look, let's not pretend that this is something that started with Trump. We have looked the other way on Saudi Arabia's behavior for a long, long time. Primarily because we know that they are the big dog in the oil markets.
Right.
And look, I mean, as a matter of realpolitik, this is a real issue. I mean, they really do have the world kind of by the short hairs when it comes to oil prices.
Sure they do.
If Saudi Arabia wanted to, they could sink the world economy into a deep recession in a week. If they really wanted to. Now, they'd hurt themselves in the process, of course.
They would hurt themselves, and quite frankly, they might end up provoking responses that I don't think they want. And I think they're smart enough to know that. So, you know, it's sort of like mutually assured destruction when it comes to nuclear deterrence. I don't think that they want to take that step because they know what the consequences might be. But, and as I said before, I'm not naive enough to think that this is something that began or will end with Donald Trump. The problem I have with it is that Trump has, again, sort of openly announced that this is all up for grabs. It's all up for sale, right? All you have to do is run up a big enough tab with my companies, with me, with the United States, and we'll look the other way to anything.
Yeah.
Anything.
And look, we all know where this is going. This ends with Trump doing nothing.
Of course it does.
That's been obvious from the start. It's been obvious that Bin Salman would pick out a few fall guys to punish, to pretend that he had nothing to do with it. Trump's going to swallow it hook, line, and sinker. And it's not because he actually believes it. It's because he doesn't care.
Right. That's
right. He doesn't care whether they killed him or not.
Absolutely.
He knows they killed him. Come on.
Right.
You know?
Sure.
He just doesn't care.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago, at the same time that this is going on, Trump goes to Montana and praises Greg Gianforte, the congressman who beat up a reporter for daring to ask him about health care the night before the election in 2016.
Once again, Donald Trump reveals his true feelings and beliefs about what it is, the kind of person he wishes he could get away with being, doesn't he?
Yeah. We say this a lot, but there's not a bottom here. There never is.
No.
It doesn't matter where you set the bar. He'll limbo under. He could limbo under an area rug.
That's exactly right. It's incredible. Every time you think he cannot possibly go lower than he has, he'll amaze you.
Yeah. It's his campaign slogan should be hold my beer.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you think that was bad? Hold my beer. Let me show you. You know. And speaking of reporters, I have a series of lawsuits I want to bring up for you, and this is the first one.
Okay.
A group that supports freedom of the press filed a lawsuit this week against Trump, claiming that Trump's many statements advocating violating the freedom of the press by loosening libel laws and punishing news outlets and such that publish things he doesn't like, that just advocating those things is a violation of the First Amendment. Now, tell me if I'm off base on this or not. It seems to me this suit is not going to win.
That's not going anywhere. That's a loser.
That unless he actually does something, merely advocating it.
Look, I don't care what you label it. You want to call it hate speech? You want to call it incitement? It's none of those things. It's vile, absolutely. But that's Donald Trump. What do you expect?
Right. Yeah, that was my reaction too. This suit's not going to survive a motion to dismiss.
No, it's gone. That's gone on a 12B6 motion instantly.
And I, you know, I mean, I think the lawsuit certainly makes a very good point. You know, it's an important thing. We need to keep the pressure up on this.
It's a point that needs to be made, but frankly, you don't make that in a court of law. You need to make that point again and again and again in the court of public opinion.
Right.
That's where that argument needs to be aired.
Yeah, I don't see that one succeeding. And speaking of a case that won't succeed, our old buddy Larry Klayman is back.
Your favorite lawyer.
My favorite lawyer, the dumbest lawyer in America not named Matt Staber.
What's Larry up to these days? Do tell.
He has filed a lawsuit against the New York Times on behalf of Sheriff Joe Arpaio over an op-ed piece they published that detailed his long history of unconstitutional actions and abuse of inmates at that infamous tent camp in Arizona. And this is my favorite part. They're seeking $147 million in damages.
I'd like to know how they plan to prove that Joe Arpaio's reputation is worth anything approaching $147 million, frankly, you know?
Yeah. Joe Arpaio is not a rich man himself, you know.
Yeah, I think they've aimed a little high with that damage estimate,
you know? I suspect it'll take the judge longer to stop laughing.
Yep.
Than it will take them to dismiss the case.
Which is a characteristic of most Larry Klayman filed lawsuits, by the way.
Yes, he's been sanctioned by multiple courts.
He
just has enraged judges for reasons that, you know, I've talked about in my writing, you and I have talked about before. I mean, his legal complaints are like political manifestos. You know, they're just boilerplate arguments, not legal arguments. And that's the kind of thing that judges really get irritated by.
They're fundraising drives. That's what they are. You know, they're fundraisers.
I had this idea. I think this would be great. So I think we should convene one of those citizen grand juries that Klayman likes so much.
Yeah.
And have them indict him for something.
We can do it in Uncle Goober's bar.
Exactly. I just would love to hear his response.
Yeah.
If some citizen grand jury indicted him for something, you know.
Right.
It would be worth the price of admission. Excuse me, still got this cough. So, another lawsuit I wanted to ask you about is right here in Michigan. The ACLU of Michigan filed a lawsuit on behalf of a woman who was having a miscarriage. And her doctor prescribed a medication called misoprostol.
Yes, I've heard about this suit.
Which would help complete the miscarriage. Now, misoprostol, if you combine it with another drug, can also induce abortions. This woman had already miscarried. And this drug was prescribed to her because it would help complete the miscarriage and flush her system. So, a pharmacist at Meijer refused to fill the prescription on religious grounds. And refused to transfer it to another store so someone else could fill it. Now, the argument the ACLU of Michigan is making here seems to me to be a bit unusual. They're arguing that because misoprostol is also prescribed to treat stomach ulcers, that if a man came in with a prescription to treat stomach ulcers, the pharmacist would not have refused to fill that one for a man. So it's discrimination to refuse to fill it for a woman for a miscarriage.
That one just does. I'm sure that the ACLU has some reason for what they've done, but you told me about this one just before we came on the air, and I'm at a loss to figure out what the angle is here. And I mean, frankly, if you want to make a gender-based claim, I'm not sure why you need the specifics of the drug to try to make that claim. It just doesn't. I don't know where they're going. Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, it just seems an unusual argument. It seems to me that there's probably better arguments to be made.
Oh, I think
the conclusion.
Yeah, I think they're right. Yeah. If you want to make a gender-based claim, how about the fact that only women can get pregnant?
Sure.
You know, and I realize that you know the Supreme Court has kind of thrown some roadblocks in the way of that one as well. But nevertheless, that seems to me to be the obvious gender-based argument, not the fact that this drug is also prescribed to men. Well, so what? Men don't get pregnant and don't need to take drugs to induce, an abortion or a miscarriage.
Yeah, I'm curious to see where they're going with this, and maybe it may be that they'll be adding more claims.
Yeah,
rounds for it at some point, and certainly I know the attorneys from the ACLU are very good.
Sure, yeah, that's why I'm curious about it. I really am, because I'd like to know what the thinking is here.
Yeah, me too, and I'm curious to see where it leads. It seems to me, like I said, there are stronger arguments to be made that this was illegal discrimination.
Yeah, I think very highly of the ACLU and the work that it does here in Michigan and everywhere, but this one has me scratching my head.
Yeah. Well, this one's really going to have you scratching your head then.
Okay.
This is my favorite lawsuit of the week.
Oh, good.
So this is in Lafayette, Louisiana. There's a group that does these events around the country that they call Drag Queen Story Hour.
Sounds like fun.
A group of drag queens go into a local public library and they read books to children.
Yeah, okay.
And, of course, this has the Christian right all pinchy in the shorts.
Yeah.
Or the petticoats.
You know,
the
just lighten up, you know. Right. Fucking lighten up. The kids probably love this stuff,
probably,
don't they?
Yeah.
You know, they probably just eat it up. Come on.
Of course, you don't have to send your kids there.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know.
Okay, you don't want them to get read to by drag queens, don't take them to the library on Saturday at 4, you know.
Right.
It's not that difficult.
Take them to church and get read to there. I don't see anything that could go wrong with that theory.
Sure. So, but in Louisiana, a group called Warriors for Christ has filed a lawsuit over this. And their claim, and you're going to love this.
Warriors for Christ. That's seriously the name, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Their claim is that it violates the Establishment Clause.
What?
Yeah.
Huh? What?
Can you guess the argument they're trying to use to make that case?
No, wait a minute. Okay, let me think about this. Hang on just a second. I gotta sort of try to connect the dots here. We've got transvestites reading to children at the public library.
Yeah.
Okay. Now these are not transvestites that are on the state of Louisiana payroll, I trust.
No.
Or otherwise in the employ of the library where they're doing the reading. So these are not state transvestites, I guess is what I'm getting at. There's no state action here behind the transvestitism, right? So, first of all,
the library and they schedule the events and allow it to happen. So, there's some connection there, but
you know, come on. I mean, it's we all know where those arguments are going to go. It's a public facility and they can't discriminate. So, I'm struggling to come up with the Establishment Clause angle here. You're going to have to.
Okay, so here's their claim. Their claim is that having drag queens read to children is part of the religion of secular humanism, and it is therefore a violation of the Establishment Clause to allow it to go on in a public library.
Okay.
They even specifically cite the Lemon Test.
Yeah, okay. First of all, let me pretend like I can take this argument seriously. The most obvious response, to me anyway, seems to be that the argument proves just a bit too much. if transvestitism is evidence of a secular humanist religion, then isn't pretty much everything else too? I like caramel sauce on my hot fudge sundaes or on my sundaes. Isn't that evidence of secular humanism as well? I just don't know what isn't evidence of secular humanism. Right.
Basically,
if transvestitism.
Their argument is that anything that we don't like is part of our enemy's religion.
And now we're getting down to the core of it, aren't we? Anything we don't like is part of our enemy's religion. Okay, now I'm beginning to see where the argument comes from.
And there actually is a background to this, and you may know the specifics, and I don't remember. It was a case back in the 60s where there was some footnote that referenced secular humanism as a possible religion of a non-supernatural religion or something in a Supreme Court case.
Well, the court has talked in various places about secular religion, a sort of civic or secular religion, one that isn't tied to any particular faith group. Now, the court has never come right out and recognized it as a religious entity or religious body. But yeah, the court has talked about that kind of thing.
But isn't that really more about sort of ceremonial deism?
Well, ceremonial deism is kind of a discrete concept. I suppose you could say it's related to secular or civic religion, but I mean, ceremonial deism really is simply nothing more than the court's way of saying we no longer associate this with any particular religion or religious faith. So the phrase "In God We Trust," the court would argue, is an instance of secular deism. It's been out there in the public realm for so long, and it's been used in the capacity that we see it on our money, for example, for so long that we simply don't associate it with any particular religion or religious practice.
Yeah, it's just a sort of lame ass excuse to carve out an exception. Where
of course it is. Right. Sure it is. That's all it is.
But yeah, I mean, secular humanism is not a religion.
No.
And even if it is, it doesn't include everything you don't like.
That's it. There you go.
It's such a ludicrous argument. And again, I mean,
this is another one that doesn't survive a motion to dismiss.
No. Let me read this to you. This is from the leader of this group, Warriors for Christ.
Okay.
I love this first sentence. The First Amendment Establishment Clause states, those who are named are prohibited from enforcing, endorsing, recognizing, respecting, or favoring any form of policy that doesn't involve one man and one woman.
What?
Boy, you're reading some details in the Establishment Clause.
I can say with a high degree of confidence, because I've read it once or twice, I don't remember any of that being in the Establishment Clause.
I don't think it was ever even considered when crafting that amendment.
You can read the Establishment Clause forwards and backwards and upside down and inside out and while playing an AC/DC record, and it doesn't say any of that.
No. This case is so dumb, it's almost hard to believe Larry Klayman isn't the attorney.
Well, yeah. You know? It's. I quite frankly, now that you mention it, it's not a pro se filing. There's actually an attorney.
No, there's actually an attorney. The head of Warriors for Christ is an attorney, although he is apparently not licensed to practice in Louisiana after some sort of trouble he got into somewhere else.
Well, then technically it's a pro se filing, and they're going to run into problems if you're not a licensed attorney. An entity or organization, and I'm assuming that this Warriors for Christ is some sort of incorporated nonprofit.
Yeah, it is. It's actually a pretty sizable group, like 225,000 members.
Well, the problem that they're going to run into then is with a non-attorney representative. The court is, I don't know if was this filed in federal court or state court? Do you know?
I don't remember. And I'm not sure that he's actually the attorney in the case.
Okay.
Although he is an attorney, they may have their own attorney. I mean, this is Louisiana.
Well, long story short, if the organization isn't represented by a licensed attorney, then the organization can't represent itself in court. And they'll get.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Right. No, that's right. That's right. Now, I should say that's the case in federal court. I don't know what the law is in Louisiana, and I'm not going to venture a guess. But in
it's an Establishment Clause case, so it's got to be a federal case, right?
Well, no, you can bring an Establishment Clause case in state court as well, so that's entirely possible. In federal court, I can tell you, that case gets bounced on a default fairly quickly.
Yeah, I don't, and even if it survives that, it's, you know, a motion for dismissal.
Right. There's no way this case is going anywhere. It's a bullshit case, and it needs to go away.
So here's another lawyer I want to bring up, but it's not a lawsuit. Do you know who Suzanne Israel Tufts is?
Oh, I can't say why. I want to say I've heard the name, but it doesn't ring any bells with me, no.
So she's an attorney from New York. She was a Trump campaign lawyer.
Okay.
Who, after he was elected, got a cushy gig at the Department of Housing and Urban Development working under Ben Carson.
There's where I've heard the name. Okay.
So this week, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke fired the Interior Department's Inspector General.
Right. Can't imagine why.
In the middle of no fewer than 14 active investigations.
Oh, maybe that had something to do with it. Okay.
Yeah, ranging from accepting rides on private planes of people seeking business with his agency to, you know, a whole host of other things. So
the grift is on.
It was quickly announced that Tufts would be moved from HUD over to the Interior Department, would be the new Inspector General.
Yes.
There was just one problem.
Not so fast.
She hadn't actually shown up for work for the last 2 months.
Uh-oh. Don't you hate when that happens?
Yeah, though she was still getting paid. So they had scheduled an interview.
That sounds like the perfect person, by the way, to be the new Inspector General
exactly.
for Brian Zinke's Interior Department. Exactly. That's exactly the kind of person he's looking for.
Exactly. So they had an interview scheduled for Thursday or Friday to sort of finalize her nomination. And she didn't show up for it, and then she quit.
Uh-oh.
The entire federal government. And it turns out she had not shown up for work for the last 2 months, but was still getting paid.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because remember, Trump only hires the very best
people. That's right. That's right. This sounds to me like a dedicated Trump administration servant, actually.
Right, sure. And like you said, it's the perfect person.
Hey.
The very best person who doesn't show up for work can't do any investigations into the other very best people that are supposed to be overseeing.
And quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, any Trump administration employee who doesn't show up for work is doing the country a tremendous service.
Right.
She's probably going to get the Presidential Medal of Freedom or something like that, isn't she?
Draining the swamp, baby.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Swamp. That's right. You can count on the Trump administration to do that.
So last week we talked about Kat Kerr, that wacko weather warrior.
Oh, yes, yes.
Away all
the weather yeah. lady. Yeah, right.
So she was back in the news this week, and this is hysterical to me.
Okay.
She spoke at a church in Colorado and claimed that she has command of an army of 33 billion angels.
Is that a fact? Wow.
And she used them against ISIS.
Oh.
So let me quote this. This is hilarious. Quote, "Even when ISIS were everywhere, my favorite thing to do is I would command my hosts to go and pull down the strongholds of Satan, commanding the ISIS, and fear would fall on them."
Fear, okay.
"They began to find weapons abandoned in the desert in the Mideast. They didn't know what happened. The ISIS would drop their weapons and run because my hosts were there. They pulled down all the demonic powers controlling them. They pulled down the strongholds. Those ISIS had no power from Satan because they couldn't hear. They were removed. Fear and confusion falls on them."
Is she going to be Trump's next UN ambassador? Is that where this is going, Ed? Is that where you're leading with all of this?
She's the front runner, isn't she? I do have a question for her, though.
Okay.
Why didn't you do this to every ISIS fighter?
Yeah, right.
If it's that easy and you got 33 billion of them around that can do this, she could destroy that entire terrorist organization in like an hour.
And why limit your good works to ISIS, sister? Why not? Right. Why didn't you invoke this special mojo of yours before 9/11?
Well, maybe she, this was before, that was before she did, you know.
I mean, she might not have had 33 billion souls to play with at that point in time. You know, it might have been, what, I don't know, 32 billion or 32,500 million. But why didn't she send these soul warriors to go fight the nasty plane hijackers? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You have this power, and you say it's so easy to do.
I'm seeing some flaws in this theory, aren't you?
I am too, yeah. You know, here's the thing. We laugh about this, and it is funny.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a serious part to this, too. There's no limit to how utterly stupid a claim has to be before some group of people, and in this case, millions of them around the country, won't swallow it whole.
Right.
And this is how people like Trump get elected, because we have millions and millions of voters who will buy into any lie.
I was going to say.
Any ridiculous claim, any unhinged conspiracy theory, no matter how inane it is.
Yeah, the problem the problem that you're describing, and I'll be a bit more succinct, there are two. Problem number one, these people are allowed to vote. Problem number two, these people are allowed to reproduce.
And the fact is, because the religious right is organized so strongly, they vote at higher rates than the rest of us.
They do. They absolutely do. These are motivated political actors. You better believe.
Yeah, they're doing the will of God.
They're, you know? That's exactly right. We are doing God's work by going to the polls.
I mean, how do you have a functioning democracy relying upon at least a reasonably educated and reasonable, rational citizenry to make choices, when a huge percentage of your population clearly is not capable of being rational?
I agree.
We have like 30% of this country at least that just, they live in an alternate reality that has no relationship to the real world.
As far as I can tell, the number is closer to 38%. So let's just round up and say 40%. And here's the tie-in to something that we've talked about before. And I don't know if you want to talk about it now or you want to save it for a later program. But this, I think, is sort of a part and parcel of my concern that the system that we have not only is not functioning, but it cannot function when, let's just say, close to half of the people who are involved are incapable of, I shouldn't say they are incapable, the people who are leading them do not act in good faith. How is a political system supposed to work when half of it is being run by people who are not acting in good faith? At the end of the day, our political and legal systems, this thing that we call the Constitution, is nothing more than words on paper. It depends for its function, it depends for its existence on the good faith of the people who are charged with running it. And when that good faith runs out, so too does the ability to run the system. It's not just that the system is broken, it's that my fear is that it's irretrievably broken, and I don't know what we do about it.
Well, I mean, look, there are certain things that we can't do about it. We can't say that people don't have the right to vote.
Of course, can't say that.
So that leaves us at a loss. I mean,
it does. Yeah, you're talking, Ed. Now, what do we do about it?
Yeah, I don't know, but I don't see how it works. And here's why does this only seem to happen here? Out of all of the like big developed nations in the world, this doesn't happen in Japan.
Right.
This doesn't happen in England or Sweden or, you know.
Well, the people here, and it's I don't think that it's just here. I think that there are other developed Western nations where we're beginning to see this kind of authoritarian populist attitude take hold as well. And I think that it derives in substantial part to the breakdown of political and social and ethical norms, and people who are willing to disregard any of those norms that they don't like, as long as it means that they get to get and keep power for themselves. That, I think, is if you want to try to drill down towards the root cause of the problem, I think that kind of gets us one step closer, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Because I guess I think that leaders, almost regardless of what kind of system you have, whether it's a monarchy or a democracy, I don't think your leaders very often act in good faith and never have. So, I mean, they've always been in it for the power more than anything else. As a generality, obviously, there are exceptions, you know. So I guess I look at that and just say that's just part of human nature, that, you know, to crave power and, you know, want to use it for personal gain. There are degrees, though.
I think there are degrees, and my point is that even, I mean, if you want to make that claim as to politicians in the 50s or 60s or 70s, I'm not going to deny that it's true, but they felt constrained by certain political and social and ethical norms, all right, that the people who are running the show today simply don't feel constrained by. They don't feel any obligation today to even make a plausible effort to do what's best for the country or to do what's best for the people. It's all about doing what we need to do immediately, right here, right now, to get ourselves elected and to keep ourselves elected. And by the way, while we are elected, to fill our pockets as quickly as possible. That's what it's all about.
But my larger concern is not that, because I just sort of accept that that's part of the way it's going to be no matter what system you have. My bigger concern is the populace, the voters. And the fact that there's so many of them that are so easily manipulated, so easily turned against their fellow man by fear, so susceptible to bigotry and xenophobia and nativism and the dumbest kinds of fear-mongering and demagoguery. I mean, we have a huge percentage of our population who are convinced that there is a war on Christmas.
Sure.
I don't know how you have a functioning country when half of them can believe such palpable nonsense.
I agree.
It's like I said, it's an alternate reality. It's, and I jokingly have called it Trump world, but it's not just Trump. It's been that way for a long time. It's gotten worse, but you know, Trump is exploiting trends that were already there, you know.
Sure.
And I find it very disturbing, and I wish I had a solution. You know, I know what we can't do. We can't say those people don't have the right to vote.
No, can't do that.
You know, there. I have entertained in the past the possibility of some sort of intelligence test or something before you get the right to vote. But there's an obnoxious history to that sort of.
Yeah, thing I don't.
We don't want to get into. Yeah, you know, that's too easily used for nefarious purposes. So I dismiss that. I don't have a solution.
If we agree that our constitutional system is, or something close to it, is the best that we can hope for, which is not to say that it's perfect. It's not, and it never will be.
No, nothing is going to be perfect.
But if we can agree that the constitutional norms that the framers aspired to, okay, not the ones they actually wrote into the document, but the ones that we like to think they aspired to, if we agree that that's the best outcome that we can hope for, that or something close to it, then I think that gives us a framework to begin with. But you're right. The problem, there are sort of the complementary components of the problem. One is the people who are charged with running the system, and the second is that at least in part, the people who are charged with running the system are people like you and me, who are supposed to be informed and knowledgeable and educated and understand the issues and able and willing to act in ways that are consistent with not just their own best interests, but the best interests of others, sort of consistent with notions of a social compact and a social order. But when those norms break down, and they have, then I don't know that the system can work. And if the system is where we find it today, what do you do? Well, again, I don't have any answers. But I'll tell you this, and if you want me to shut up because I'm just rambling on.
No, please go on.
The whole Lafayette Kavanaugh, if we might call it that, was such a stark and bright line illustration for me. The Kavanaugh nomination, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, the Kavanaugh confirmation was not about Brett Kavanaugh. It was not about the United States Supreme Court or the Constitution or the rule of law or even the best interest of the country. It had nothing to do with any of that, in my estimation. It was entirely about privilege and power and entitlement, specifically the privilege, the power, the entitlement of white males in this country. And what happens when you threaten that implicit order? Let me tell you, those folks don't like it one bit when their privilege, their power, their entitlement is threatened. And when I use the word entitlement, that's what it is. We are entitled to make the rules.
Right. It's our birthright.
It is our birthright to make these rules. And we can take, by the way, whatever we want. That includes the power. We're entitled to it. And if you disagree, watch out. We are going to throw one hell of a temper tantrum. And that's what happened. And if you think things are going to get better, let me tell you, they're going to get a lot worse before they get better. Watch out.
You know, in my view, it's not the Constitution itself. I mean, I think there's problems with our Constitution, and there's some amendments I'd like to see made.
Sure.
But I think the framework of the Constitution is generally a pretty solid.
Best we can
It's the norms that underlie it that are the real danger here. Because, the founders were smart enough to realize human ambition is a powerful thing.
Sure.
The tendency toward what they called factions and dividing us up was powerful.
Yes, the tribal instinct that is deeply ingrained in our DNA.
Right, and their solution to this was a limited government with checks and balances and a separation of powers. And that's a system that's as good as you can do, I think, to restrain the sort of worst impulses of human nature. I think that's solid.
Yeah, the problem is it doesn't work. It's not working now. That's not what we've got now. We have a system.
But it's because we've undermined the norms.
That's right. That's what I've been saying.
That underlie all these things. No matter what's on paper in the Constitution, if the norms that underlie it are no longer seen as valid or binding on us, then we're simply going to reinterpret the words of the Constitution to fit our new reality.
That's precisely the point I've been trying to make, and I think you're making it in more eloquent language than I have. The system is not working, and it's not working because the norms have broken down, and one of the reasons why the norms have broken down is that the people who are in charge are more than happy to look the other way. The system of checks and balances has broken down. We don't have checks and balances anymore. We don't have them at the federal level. We don't have them at the state level. Everything is not everything, but the substantial majority of the levers of power in this country are controlled by Republicans. They haven't won it fair and square, but they've won it. And the only thing that stands really between where we are now, if you stop and think about this, the only thing that stands between where we are now and Donald Trump and a GOP Congress and a GOP Supreme Court doing everything that they want to do is a very small handful of executive department officials. And now I'm thinking of, in particular, Rod Rosenstein and Bob Mueller and the people that work with them and for them and who are trying to see the investigation through to completion. Those are the only people that are acting as any kind of an effective check on Donald Trump and his administration right now. And guess what? I wouldn't put any bets on Rod Rosenstein's tenure in office or Bob Mueller's tenure in office, for that matter.
Not after the midterms.
That's right. That's
right. I think there's a really good chance that this all blows up after the midterms.
Rod Rosenstein goes. Lindsey Graham is in as the new AG, and it's all bets are off.
And this is the result of decades of abdication of responsibility and ceding more power to the executive.
Clearly.
Congress has completely abdicated its oversight responsibilities as a check on the executive branch, and that has been going on for decades. And so what happens when you strip away all of these sort of safeguards and all this oversight, and then you get somebody like Donald Trump in office without those constraints there anymore, because he doesn't care.
Yeah.
You get what we see happening today.
And by the way, none of this is the result of some sort of unfortunate political accident or a series of unfortunate political accidents. This was all deliberate. This was all calculated on the part of the GOP and the people who were running it. They made a decision in the late 1950s, early 1960s to shake hands with the devil. And by that, I mean the Democrats sort of saw the handwriting on the wall and realized that racism being the party of no civil rights wasn't the future, that the country was changing demographically, and that they were going to need to sort of change their political views. Well, the Republicans were more than happy to step into that void. And that's not, I realize that's not the only contributing factor. There are others. But my point is, this was a deliberate, concerted effort that began in the late 50s, early 1960s to transform the GOP into what it is today. With all of the, as bad as the outcomes have been, I think that one of the things that people who oppose the GOP, which is to say Democrats and independents, fail to appreciate is the degree to which the GOP infrastructure has been created, organized, and funded, and it works like a well-oiled machine, let me tell you.
And I think that there is a minority view among Republicans now that have started to come to the realization of, oh my God, what did we unleash?
Sure, yeah.
And I'm thinking particularly of Max Boot.
Yes.
Who has a new book out about it, who is a longtime Republican foreign policy expert. He's actually a Soviet emigre, came here with his family from the Soviet Union. He has advised many, many Republican presidents over the years. He's a real expert on the Cold War and foreign policy in particular. And he has, I read an interview with him this week in which he said, basically, we're going to have to burn this party to the ground.
Yeah.
What we have unleashed is going to destroy it all. And
yeah.
There's
he's a classic example of what is sometimes called the Country Club Republican, I think, or the group that I call the Country Club Republicans. These are the people who were sort of the moderate Republicans of the 1950s before Buckley and Goldwater and the transformation of the 1960s. I'll tell you who it reminds me of. It reminds me of my dad. My dad was the classic country club Republican, kind of a moderate on virtually all issues.
Right. Mine is the same way, yeah.
Yeah. Dad, he died in 2011, and while I certainly miss him, I have to say there's a part of me that's glad that he didn't live to see what has come to pass and what the GOP has come to be. He would be beside himself.
Oh, my dad is. Yeah, he spits fire over this.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
But I think Boot's a little bit. I don't really look at him as a country club Republican. I look at him as an intellectual conservative.
Yeah,
and a consistent one. You can trace his views back to, Russell Kirk and Edmund Burke. And these are serious people. I mean, this is conservatism as a set of principles is not necessarily a bad thing. Conservatism as a sort of the modern tribe of conservatives is a terrible thing. And there are at least a small percentage of these people who are sort of genuine, principled, intellectual conservatives who have recognized what's going on. And to Max Boot's great credit, I mean, this interview that he was asked about it, and it was a Salon magazine doing the interview, so a pretty liberal, source that was asking about this. And they asked him, But doesn't this really go back to the sort of long history of the Republican Party? Like, this didn't just happen with Trump. And he said, no, you're right. He goes, and that's something that I have had to really go back and reexamine for myself and say, why did I fall for it?
Yeah.
You know, why did I look the other way?
Yeah. This has been going on since at least the early 1960s, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
And the problem for the Max Boots of the world and what we might call the moderate or country club Republicans is that today they're such a tiny, tiny majority. And I'm afraid that they no longer either reflect or have any degree of significant influence or control over what the GOP does or the direction that it's headed. So that kind of brings us back to the point that you ascribe to Boot, which is, is he right that it's necessary to sort of burn it to the ground and salt the earth over it and start over again? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I mean, I think so, but how do you do it?
Yeah, I don't. Well, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you pull that off.
Right, and I there's a part of me that really relates to people like Boot, because I've had situations like that where I sort of came to a realization too late about the reality of the world, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And went, boy, why didn't I see this?
Well, and here's the other side of that coin, and that is, even if we could come up with a plan that said, okay, here's what needs to happen with the GOP, it needs to go away, the question then becomes, what do you replace it with? We
right.
can't have a system with just one party.
Right.
The health of the system, the health of the country, depends upon having opposing parties with opposing interests who fight with one another, but do so in a context where they all recognize that our common goal is ultimately the welfare of the country and its people and doing what's best and right for the greatest number. And so you've got to have two parties to make that work.
Right.
And that just is no longer the case. It's no longer the case that we have a functional, effective, two-party working system.
I feel like we need to like unplug the country and plug it back in.
Yeah, restart. You know? Hit the restart button. You know.
And it's profoundly disturbing to me on so many levels. What's going on? And like I said, you and I talk about this all the time, and we see the problems. I wish I had a solution. I really...
Well, you know, the other thing, and I realize we're short on time, so this may have to be it, but the other thing is that if you sort of study the long arc of history, what you realize is that to some extent, this is a pendulum, isn't it? It swings from one direction back to the other direction, and the party that's in power eventually gets too full of itself, and it gets too much power, and things start to go too far in that direction. And I'm thinking here of the sort of ultra-liberalism of the mid to late 1960s that ended up turning a lot of people off. And I think that was part of what created a vacuum that allowed folks like Nixon to sort of step in and say, okay, we're off to the races. So maybe we can hope that the pendulum is swinging, but it's going to eventually swing to the point where we say, okay, enough is enough. We simply have gone too far, and we let things sort of recenter themselves. Maybe we'll see that happen. I don't know that I'm confident.
Yeah, my fear is that it's not a pendulum so much as it is an inevitable decline.
Well, you could be right, my friend.
And that we're looking at sort of the fall of the Roman Empire here, you know.
Yeah, I worry the same.
And I probably won't live long enough to see the result.
Nor will I.
But I'm, for the first time in my life, genuinely scared for my country.
Yeah, did you ever think, Ed, that you would live to see the day where we would be having this serious conversation about the future of the country, and not in a, you know, a couple of geezers sitting on the front porch screaming at the kids to get off our lawn? That I'm very conscious of not doing that, and
right.
I try not to do that. But did you ever think that you would really be having this serious conversation? I didn't.
No, and I, like I said, I mean, certainly we've had presidents that I've disagreed with enormously and criticized very strongly.
Of course.
But I never did I fear that we had sort of reached the end.
Yeah.
And I'm no longer convinced that that's the case. I'm no longer convinced that pendulum can swing back in the other direction. And I hope I'm wrong, and I hope it does, and I'm trying my best to help it happen. But I'm not, I don't feel confident in it.
No,
I'm not putting any money down on it.
I'm not an optimist. I saw a figure today. Generic polls show the Democrats up by 9 points in the midterm elections. That's barely enough, I think, for the Democrats to take the House, if those numbers hold. And I'm not saying they will, because the vote suppression efforts are running fast and furious all over the country. So I'm not confident. I think I'm on record saying I'm not predicting, I'm not willing to accept predictions that the Democrats will take the House. I'll believe it when I see it. But the larger point is I'm not optimistic about the long-term prospects of the country either at this moment.
And the thing that scares me most about that is that you look at what happened to England after World War II.
Yeah.
And England was the United States.
Sure.
For centuries. I mean, they were the dominant power in the world.
Absolutely.
Colonizing, half of Africa and Asia. But after World War II, when they were so destroyed by the fight with the Nazis, and we came out of it looking stronger, they almost willingly gave that over to us.
Yes, they
like,
did.
Like, God, we're first of all, we're not a big enough country to sustain it. And it's not worth the hassle.
Right.
It's your turn. And it was almost an exhaustion-based willingness to let it go. We won't go out like that.
No, we won't.
We'll go out in a blaze of glory.
But your point is nevertheless well taken, and I think it might be summarized as nothing lasts forever, does it?
Right. No, it doesn't. But I'm afraid that this United States is so arrogant and so convinced of its birthright to rule the world.
Yes.
That, especially if we're starting to elect people like Trump, like I said, we're going to go out in a blaze of glory. We're going to go out with thermonuclear weapons blazing. We aren't going to just walk away from it and let it die.
In other words, if we can't have all the toys, nobody else gets them.
Exactly. That's, I think, would be the quintessentially American response to that decline.
American exceptionalism.
Yeah. To the world's detriment. So, yeah. I'm terrified for the future. I really am.
If I had little kids today, I'd be making sure that they learn Mandarin.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what I would tell them.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to know where the world's next great superpower is, I would say look to the east.
Yeah. Well, now that we've thoroughly depressed ourselves and everybody else.
Yeah, thanks, Ed.
Jeez.
You're out of the hospital for a week and you start thinking about this stuff again.
I know.
And look where we are. Come on.
I know. So anyway, thank you all for listening, and join us again next week for another episode of Culture Wars Radio.
Thanks, everybody.
Singing born of this nation of white bread foundation, we're taping our king beaten off his crown. My country.